All right, well, like Chad said, it is May the 4th, and somebody asked me this morning how many Star Wars references would be in the sermon today, and I'm sorry, it didn't even cross my mind. And I realized that loses me some credibility with some of you, and we should have thought about that. We should have had Perry up here this morning, but we didn't. So I hope I can earn some of your trust back this morning. And I'll do that with some of you. This may work. I'm going to start actually with a Bob Dylan quote. And about 60 years ago, Bob Dylan famously sang, "The times they are a-changin'." And that was certainly true when he sang it of his time. But you know, I think he could sing it again right now, and it would be true. That the times are a-changin' right now. And they're changing in a lot of different ways, but specifically what I want to focus on this morning is that I believe our world is changing in terms of openness to Christianity. We've mentioned that a few times in recent weeks, but I think it's true, at least the beginnings of it are true, that something seems to be a little different, and we have that sense, and some of the data's coming in, and we see in different pockets of the world, increases in Bible sales and church attendance, and we see it happening with demographics that we might not expect it to happen with, and we see it happening in places where we might not expect it. You know, just this past month, Vanity Fair had an article. It's called "God Complex: Christianity was borderline illegal in Silicon Valley. Now it's the new religion." And this article explains that. And it says this: for many years, mostly in the 2010s, the running joke, popularized by the HBO show Silicon Valley, was that in the Bay Area, Christianity was borderline illegal. But things seem to be changing. Goes on to say this: it used to be that the 20-something whiz kid who coded a viral game and dropped out of Stanford was a venture capitalist darling. VCs used to throw money at that guy, said a woman who manages communications at a top-tier venture firm. Now if someone comes in and says, "I love my parents so much, I grew up going to church, and then I joined the army, and that's what gives me my work ethic," VCs will be like, "That guy. Let's fund that guy." And then it explains further, and it says this: it's becoming appealing to stand out in a monoculture in which polycules and ketamine, basically sex and drugs, are mundane. They're mundane. But attending Sunday church service is subversive. You know, in cities like San Francisco and New York, being a Christian is a little bit of a vice, said a San Francisco consultant. In other words, the new religion is religion. And apparently in cities like this, in influential places, there has been a monoculture, of course, for many decades, pursuing hedonism to its extreme, and it seems like there's a tiring of that, and all of a sudden, Christianity seems to be appealing. And there are, in addition to that, there are a handful of popular, public, non-Christian intellectuals who are speaking very fondly of Christianity. Okay, whether that's Jordan Peterson or historian Tom Holland or journalist Louise Perry, they are speaking out loud things that are very positive about Christianity, even though they're not Christians. And all that to me is just weird. It just it feels weird. I became a Christian in 1996 as a college student. And I think many of the formative years of my faith were in the middle of the heyday of the new atheism, where there were a number of popular, articulate, sometimes bombastic atheists that would publicly ridicule Christianity. And it felt like Christians were very much on the defensive, and that in many public places, Christianity was dismissed and belittled. And of course, that's still true in a lot of ways, but it just seems like it's a little different. It is strange to me to have non-Christian intellectuals speaking affectionately about Christianity. And I think seeing that, it's not because the arguments have changed. It's not like last year somebody came up with this new line of evidence for Christianity and everybody said, oh, now I get it. Now I can trust this. No, the case for Christianity has been pretty consistent for quite a while. So it's not this like this new argument came up, but the old arguments seem to be landing like they didn't before. At least that's just the sense that I think a lot of people are getting. They seem to be landing, and there could be a lot of reasons for that. One, a movement of God, where God, in his ultimate wisdom and providence, just decides to do something. He says, okay, we're going to move here. So there's that. But also, I think there's this sense of just a lack of meaning. Perhaps the new atheism didn't give that sense of meaning in the world. And maybe COVID accelerated that sense or that lack of meaning. And therefore, people are looking for meaning in different places and sometimes in some ancient sources. And so they're turning to Christianity, or at least slices of Christianity. And perhaps some are appealing to the moral framework, the ethic of Christianity, or some the philosophical principles, or some of the ascetic practices, where they're looking to ancient monasticism and drawing from these mystical or meditative practices, sometimes developing patterns of life where they mine Christian resources for rules of life. That sort of thing. But although that is very exciting, that people are looking to Christianity and mining those resources, it's not enough. Because we don't just need Christianity, we need Christ. And it's interesting how a lot of these public figures, they are speaking very positively about Christianity, but many of them have yet to have an encounter with Jesus, to have an encounter with the person of Jesus in a personal way. But that's what's needed. And that's why we just started this new series that we started last week, and we're calling it Encounter Jesus. And that's what we need to do. It's really this call, this invitation to encounter the person of Jesus, to know him. And when we do that, when we encounter Jesus, of course we're encountering God. We're trying to get to know God, but if we ask, well, what is God like? How do we know him? Well, the answer is, what is Jesus like? We look at Jesus. In Jesus, we see God. Colossians 1, 15 and 19 says, he's the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell. And Hebrews 1, 3, he is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of his nature, and he upholds the universe by the word of his power. Okay, the exact imprint, the fullness of God dwells in Jesus. And so when we see Jesus, we are seeing God. And so we want to see Jesus. We want to immerse ourselves in who Jesus is. That's the point of this series. So for 4 months, we're just going to be swimming in Jesus stories. And we're going to be pulling different stories from the Gospels, the biographies of Jesus. And we're just going to get to know him. We're going to get to know how he interacted with people, what he did in different situations, and thereby we're going to get to know God. We're going to get to know what kind of person God is. And as we get to know him, it should stir a love in us for him. Okay, when you know Jesus, you love him, and then you obey him and you follow him. And so that's the goal. That's the goal of this series. And Perry introduced that last week, and we're just going to go again through the next 4 months just swimming in those Jesus stories from the Gospels. We're going to mainly spend our time in what are called the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, because we taught through John not too long ago. but we're going to pull a lot of different stories from those Gospels. And this morning, we are going to start with an early story. We'll go somewhat chronologically as we walk through the life of Jesus. And we're going to start with the one story that we have of Jesus as a boy. Now, we have the Christmas story. We have the birth narratives, but we talk about those at Christmas a lot, so we're going to skip over those. And we're going to start with this story of Jesus when he was 12 years old. So it's Luke 2, 39 through 52. You can open up your house Bibles to page 858 if you'd like to follow along, although I will have the verses up on the screen as well. And this is a bit of an obscure story, I think. I've never taught on it. I don't know that I've ever actually heard teaching on it in our circles. But I think it is important, and I think it introduces us to the humanity of Jesus. And that's what we're going to get to know a little bit as Jesus grows up and goes through childhood. And so we're just going to try to pull a few thoughts and ideas from this story and just get to know Jesus. And I hope this will set us up for future weeks well. Okay. So, Luke 2, 39, what we're going to do, I'm just going to have a couple verses up on the screen at a time. We'll read those verses and then share a few thoughts and then go on to the next couple verses. And so we'll start with verses 39 and 40. And when they had performed everything according to the law of the Lord, they returned into Galilee to their own town of Nazareth. And the child grew and became strong, filled with wisdom, and the favor of God was upon him. And so, when they had performed everything according to the law of the Lord, so it's referencing what Luke had just recorded previously, and Jesus had been presented at the temple. And so we have the birth narratives. Jesus is born. 8 days later, he's circumcised. 40 days, when he's 40 days old, it was the law to take him before the temple, to present him at the temple. And so at 40 days, they brought him to the temple. Joseph and Mary did, and they presented Jesus there. And after that, it says they returned to Galilee to their own town of Nazareth. Now, Matthew includes a little bit more in there that Luke does not include because we have the flight to Egypt. And so Matthew records that after Jesus was born, sometime after he was born, the wise men came. And they worshiped Jesus, and then they left. But Herod, the King Herod, realized he'd been duped by the wise men, and so then he gets really mad, and he wants to kill Jesus because he feels threatened by him that he might be the coming king. And so he tries to kill him, but an angel had warned Joseph and Mary to flee to Egypt, and so they had. And they wait till Herod dies, and then an angel again tells them to come back, and so they can come back now. We don't know exactly when they came back or how old Jesus was. I think we can probably assume that he was maybe a toddler to kind of the pre-K age, perhaps, when they returned from Egypt. And so after that, they came back, and then, like the passage says, they moved to Galilee and to Nazareth. And let's just get our geographical bearings here. I don't know that you can see that well, but there's basically Israel, and we're going to point out three key regions that are labeled up on the map, and those would be Judea, Samaria, and Galilee. And so Judea down there in the south, that's where Jerusalem is. That's where a lot of the core of Judaism happens. And so that's what's going on down there. The core of the Jewish nation is down there in Judea, where Jerusalem is. And just to the north of that is Samaria. And Samaritans and Jews didn't like each other. Samaritans were of mixed ethnicity, and they were part Jew and part Gentile, and so they didn't get along. And so Samaria is right to the north of Judea, and then to the north of that is Galilee. And Galilee, again, part of the nation of Israel here, but it's removed from the core there, down there in Judea, and separated by Samaria, so they're off in the boonies up there in the north. But that's where Jesus and his family returns to, and that's where he grows up, and that's probably where he spent most of his growing up years after they returned from Egypt. Let's point out the key towns there. We've got Nazareth up there in the north and Jerusalem down there in the south. So let's keep going. Let's read our next two verses. Now his parents went to Jerusalem every year at the feast of the Passover. And when he was 12 years old, they went up according to custom. Okay, so they went every year at the Feast of the Passover. And a Jewish family may make this pilgrimage to Jerusalem even multiple times a year. There were three key feasts that may be attended as a good Jewish family, and that would be Passover and Pentecost and the Feast of Tabernacles, but at least Passover. They'd probably go to Passover every year. But what I want to point out, first of all, is this is not a quick journey. Okay, so if we go back to our map, we've got Nazareth and we've got Jerusalem down there in the south, and it's about 60 miles as the crow flies between Nazareth and Jerusalem. But Jesus and his family, they weren't crows. And so they probably would have gone around Samaria, maybe gone over to the Jordan River Valley and gone down that way and then cut back over to Jerusalem. And so you might figure that it was more like an 80, 90 mile trip. It could have taken a week or more to get there. And they went in a pretty large caravan of people, a lot of the town of Nazareth and maybe the surrounding towns, perhaps journeying together. And so it was a pretty significant trip that they would take down there. Again, maybe a week plus to get down there. They might spend a week plus there. The Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread, right after the Passover. And so they might have been there for a while, and they journey a week plus back. This is a big part of their year. You know, if you can imagine that, 3 or 4 weeks, you're taken out of your life. You're dropping what you're doing, you're dropping your trade or whatever you do at home, and you're packing up a lot of your family, and you're journeying down here. It's a pretty significant part of life, and this would have been significant in the upbringing of Jesus, this journey to Jerusalem each year. So this was not a quick journey. Secondly, a boy in early adolescence would have begun to accompany his parents on such a journey in the years leading up to him becoming a son of covenant. This is apparently what was typical of Jewish boys. You know, even today, Jewish families will celebrate a bar mitzvah and really this transition into adulthood, a boy going from boyhood to manhood. It's at 13 years old. And even back at this time, although the ceremony itself did come later, there was still this sense that a boy would transition into manhood. But perhaps in the year or two leading up to that transition, a boy may have been taken along on a trip like this. Perhaps the whole family didn't go. Perhaps they did. But it seems from what I've read that it was common in the year or two leading up to that official transition point, a boy may have been taken on a journey like this just in preparation and to get to understand what was going on. We don't know for sure, obviously, but this could have been Jesus' first trip to Jerusalem here with his family. And so at 12 years old, they go to Jerusalem. Next few verses. And when the feast was ended, as they were returning, the boy Jesus stayed behind in Jerusalem. His parents did not know it. But supposing him to be in the group, they went a day's journey. But then they began to search for him among their relatives and acquaintances. And when they did not find him, they returned to Jerusalem searching for him. Okay, so Joseph and Mary leave Jesus in Jerusalem at 12 years old. Now, that may seem a little off here that they forgot about Jesus, but I'm just going to say that this might not have been that hard to do, to leave him here. This kind of home alone type thing is going on, and remember they are in this big caravan of people. A lot of their family, their friends, their acquaintances were going back and forth between Nazareth or Galilee and Jerusalem, and so it's this big group of people that was traveling together. Jesus also was, remember, at this kind of intermediate age, and it could have been likely that there were different groups in this larger group of people traveling back and forth. The men and the older boys may have traveled generally together, and maybe the women and the younger boys may have traveled together. That's what is thought. Jesus in this intermediate age could have gone either direction. And so it's likely that mom could have thought Jesus is with dad, and dad thought Jesus is with mom. Parents, you've been there. And we have done that in our home as well. We thought, I'm pretty sure he's with her. And that may have been going on. And so this big group of people traveling back and forth, but they don't realize that Jesus is not with them. And they travel for about a day. Again, this is a week or more long journey, and they're traveling. And a day into that, they realize he's not with us. And so they of course are pretty upset. And we'll keep reading. It says, after 3 days, they returned to Jerusalem searching for him, and after 3 days they found him in the temple, sitting among the teachers, listening to them and asking them questions. And all who heard him were amazed at his understanding and his answers. So after 3 days, they probably traveled a day, and then they had to travel back a day, and then they maybe spent a day searching for him. And so maybe those are the 3 days. Regardless, this is pretty significant. Jesus was just there for 3 days without his family here at 12 years old. And of course, we don't know, was he just in the temple that whole time, or temple courts? And did he sleep somewhere? Did he eat? And we don't know, but for three good days, he was there. So his parents come back, and they find him sitting at the temple among the teachers. Okay, all these wise, learned men who knew the scriptures very well, and just talking with them. And he's asking them questions and engaging in this conversation with them and answering them, and it's just amazing. Everybody is blown away by the profound wisdom of this young boy as he talks with these very, very learned men. He had an amazing wisdom at this very young age. Going on, and when his parents saw him, they were astonished. Of course, it is astonishing. Everybody was astonished that this boy is speaking like he is. And his mother said to him, "Son, why have you treated us so?" And so there's almost a little bit of a scolding here. Of course, she's upset. "Behold, your father and I have been searching for you in great distress." And obviously, that would be distressing. They're missing their boy for 3 days, and he's an important boy, and they know that. They couldn't find him, and so they were distressed, and they're full of just anxiety about this. And he said to them, "Why were you looking for me? Did you not know that I must be in my Father's house?" And they did not understand the saying that he spoke to them. And I think this is pretty key. I think this is probably why Luke, through the Holy Spirit, recorded this story for us. Because this is the first demonstration of an awareness of his position as the unique Son of God. And Jesus seems to expect Joseph and Mary to understand that it was very appropriate that he would be right there in his Father's house. And he is speaking as if he is the unique Son of God. And not in a general sense, like everybody's a child of God, but in a very unique way, he is the Son of God, and it was very natural for him to be with his Father. And so when he journeyed to Jerusalem, that was where he was going to be. He longed to be right there with his Father. And so he spent those 3 days just there and conversing with the teachers. And they didn't understand this. This was hard. I'm sure this was difficult for them, obviously. They knew he was unique. They knew the whole birth narrative, of course. They understood some things, but they didn't quite get it, and he was communicating something probably new. I'm sure this was hard for Joseph to hear him speaking about this. Joseph is here referred to as Jesus' father. Joseph is not referred to later when Jesus starts his ministry at age 30. Presumably he had passed away, but here he's very much there. And Joseph and Mary are just wrestling through this. So let's go on and finish with the last couple verses of this passage and then talk about it a little bit more. "And he went down with them and came to Nazareth and was submissive to them. And his mother treasured up all these things in her heart. And Jesus increased in wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and man. So Mary treasured up all these things in her heart, and Luke had mentioned that earlier in this chapter as well, and he's just communicating. Mary is really pondering and really trying to have these events and these experiences penetrate deep into her heart, and she's collecting up all these ministries and memories and processing what all this means and what is going on here with my son. And she's thinking about all of this. But what I wanted to focus on here is what I think can feel like a bit of a theological stumbling block here, right at the end of this passage. And it says that Jesus increased in wisdom. Jesus increased in wisdom. And I just shared earlier from Colossians and Hebrews that all the fullness of God dwells in Jesus. He's the exact imprint of the nature of God. Jesus is God. God, though, has perfect, ultimate wisdom. So how do we think about this if Jesus is increasing in wisdom? We could also go to Hebrews chapter 5. It says, in the days of his flesh, Jesus offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death, and he was heard because of his reverence. Although he was a son, he learned obedience through what he suffered. And being made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation to all who obey him, being designated by God a high priest after the order of Melchizedek. And so we're talking about Jesus learning, Jesus increasing in wisdom. And we're getting into here the mystery of the incarnation. Just the mystery of God becoming man. And I think as we really begin our 4-month series here, getting to know Jesus, it's probably important to take a few minutes and just mull over what the incarnation means. Try to understand it a little bit more, at least for a few minutes here, and we'll do that, of course, more as we go through this series. Now, to begin with, the incarnation is one of those ideas that is not fully comprehensible to us. And I think we can be okay with that to an extent. We cannot fully comprehend with our puny, finite minds everything about God. And I think that's the way it should be. You know, if God was pretty comprehensible to us, that might mean that he wasn't that different than us. But I think we want a God that transcends our understanding in many ways. And we want a God who has mystery as well. So that's a good thing. But that shouldn't stop us from exploring and trying to understand more and more who God is and what he's like and what the incarnation is like. And so let's try to do that at least a little bit. And let's go to a very famous, very important passage here about this. It's Philippians 2, 5 through 8, which says, "Have this mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus, who, though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself by taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men, and being found in human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross." And so have this mind among yourselves. And he's referring to what he just described in the previous verses here in Philippians 2. This attitude of humility, this attitude of considering others, you know, thinking about others' interests other than your own, and that was the attitude that Jesus had. So he said, "Have that mind, which is yours in Christ Jesus." Then he says, "Who though he was in the form of God." Okay, the form of God, and then that's contrasted with the form, taking the form of a servant, which is really equivalent to becoming a man. So he's contrasting these things, the form of God, and then the form of a servant or a man. Now, form here is talking really about the true and the exact meaning of something, really its nature. He's saying Jesus, by nature, is God, but then he takes on an additional nature. He takes on the nature of man as well. He didn't cling tightly, he didn't grasp his divine nature alone or only, but he took on this additional nature as well. And this process is described with a little phrase in verse 7. It talks about him emptying himself. Okay, so Jesus emptied himself. And this is a difficult word and a difficult concept to translate. Here in the ESV, it translates it emptied himself, although even in a previous version of the ESV, it translates it, made himself nothing. That's how the NIV translates it as well. So Jesus emptied himself or made himself nothing. And regardless of how it is translated, how should we think about it? How should we think about this emptying? Well, I want to summarize what I think we could consider the orthodox Christian position here. I think it's important just to lay this out here as we begin our series, just what the Bible presents. Because the Bible does present a view of God, a view of Jesus and his nature. And in the early centuries after Jesus, there were all these heresies that sprouted up, challenging the biblical view of God. And so the church had to respond and push back on these different challenges. And although it was there all the time, there in the Bible, there was this description of the nature of Jesus, it still had to be kind of formalized and codified over those first few centuries. And by the fifth century, there was the Chalcedonian Creed that was put out, that was written, summarizing this biblical position in opposition to all of these heresies. And I won't read the creed, but I am going to list four truths that are affirmed in this orthodox position, and here they are. Number one, Jesus Christ is fully divine. Number two, Jesus Christ is fully human. Number three, the divine and human natures of Christ are distinct. Number four, the divine and human natures of Christ are fully united in one person. Okay? So those four statements really summarize the Christian position on who Jesus is and how this incarnation worked. And it is difficult, but we have to hold on to each of those statements. Because again, these heresies will push on one or more of each of them. But when we understand that, we try to think about this emptying process, and I think we can say these things about Jesus emptying himself. Number one, Jesus emptied himself of what we could call role or status or privilege or position, but Jesus did not empty himself of essential attributes or nature. He didn't become less God when he became man. He was still fully divine, fully God, and that is actually important to hold on to. Jesus did not empty himself of his godness, his essential attributes or nature. And we might ask, well, does this really matter? These difficult theological thoughts. Well, yes, it does. And we can really get in the weeds if we don't hold on to all of these truths. But it also matters for how we see God the person and relate to him, how we see Jesus. You know, what picture of God do we have? It is important to understand that correctly so that we can know him well and love him. Now, there's no perfect analogy. There's no way to fully describe what took place here. This is pretty unique. But we can try. I think we get glimpses of it here and there. Perhaps the most recognizable picture of something like this happening is through parenthood. And you parents, you have experienced something like this kind of emptying process. Okay, whenever you've played dumb games with your kids, like Candyland or Chutes and Ladders, or any of those things that take zero critical thinking, okay, you are choosing not to engage all of your faculties. And you're getting on their level, and you're relating to them, you're helping them. Or maybe you've done some activity or played a sport with your younger kids, I remember with my three boys when they were younger playing football with them, and we'd go out and throw the football around, and then we'd play a game, and say they're like 5, 7, and 9 or something like that. And when they're those ages, they're not very good. Okay, they're just not very good at football. And they're slow, and they don't throw or catch the ball very well, and they're easy to knock over. And every time they get the ball, I can just blow them up, really. But I choose not to. Most of the time. Sometimes they need it. But most of the time, I'm going to limit the expression of all my attributes. I still have them. Okay, I'm still able to assert my authority and my strength in that context. But I am choosing to not express my full nature, all of my attributes. And I'm doing that in order for them, one, to connect with them, to relate to them, but also to bring them up, in a sense. Because every time they get the ball, I just wreck their world. They're not going to learn. They're not going to enjoy football at all. Okay, they're going to turn from it. I get down and I understand their level, and I play at that level, and then I help them take steps to the next level. And there's some sort of emptying that goes on there. And I think as we're thinking about Jesus and we're thinking about God, we are understanding that God is the kind of person that does something like that. You know, he's not someone who gives up his nature, becoming lesser. He's not easily manipulated. But he is one who stoops and he makes himself accessible. And when we see that, when that dawns on us, when that settles on us, it just opens us up to this affection, I think, for God. He emptied himself so that he even experienced childhood and growth and everything that comes along with that. You know, he learned how to crawl and to walk and to run and to eat food, tie his sandals and to read. He lost his baby teeth. He went through puberty. He even learned and he increased in wisdom. And again, it's not comprehensible, and it's so hard for us to really see what all is going on there. But this is what happened, where Jesus emptied himself in this mysterious way. He chose not to employ all of those attributes of deity that he still retained in order to connect with us and to draw us up to himself. And what's even more amazing is what we read in verse 51. Remember, he went down with them and came to Nazareth and was submissive to them. That's pretty wild. Jesus was submissive to Joseph and Mary, his earthly parents. Now, Joseph and Mary, of course, were from this obscure, backwards town in Galilee, Nazareth. They were young. We don't know their ages, but it's likely that, you know, Joseph might have been 30 at this point when Jesus is 12. Maybe he was older than that. Mary probably wasn't yet 30. They're still fairly young, I would say. And they weren't learned. Joseph was a tradesman. He was in that setting at the temple speaking with all the teachers of the law, he probably would have felt very insecure. And out of place. He probably just wouldn't have really, it would have been a struggle for him perhaps to track with a lot of that conversation. And so these were Jesus's parents, and he submitted to them. And that's really, again, just really pretty wild. I mean, have you ever submitted to someone that you have more competency than? Or you've been in that position and you realize, at least in certain areas, this person in this role above me has less competency than me. And yet you choose to submit to that person. That's a pretty difficult thing to do. It's pretty crazy. That's what Jesus did. And he honored these structures and roles that God had set up. He was really honoring this position of parent that God had created. And he said, okay, even though I obviously have more competency and more wisdom than these two people, I'm going to honor and respect them. And Jesus, the Son of God, chooses to do that. Okay, he chooses to go through these processes, this process of growing up through childhood, and he even submits to his parents. I'd like to invite the band to come on back up as I'm just wrapping up with a few thoughts here. But that is pretty amazing when we consider that. And I think when we consider the childhood of Jesus, it doesn't diminish our view of God, but it enlarges it. Okay, sometimes we can think of it, we struggle, like, is this blasphemous to talk about Jesus going through puberty or something like that? To grow up, to learn, to increase in wisdom, I believe it enhances and enlarges our view of God when we see him as someone who would, in the sense that Philippians talks about, empty himself, refrain from expressing all the attributes that he possesses in order to be in the likeness of a servant, to be a man, first a baby and a boy, and then a man, in order to reach out and to be accessible to us and then draw us in. He stoops down, he condescends, he even submits here. And that doesn't take away from all that he is. He's still the king, the one in authority, but he makes himself accessible and available. And he is the same today. Just like Hebrews said, he is the same yesterday, today, and forever. Jesus is that one that opens himself, that comes to us, that understands where we are, and he seeks. And I hope, again, as we start this series, we can just start by seeing who God is in the incarnation and seeing a God who loves enough to make himself accessible even though he is so far above us. And as our eyes are open more and more to that willingness, we will grow in this love and affection for him.